Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Where's the money? Where's the money?
Money talks.
Everybody needs money. That's why they call it money.
Isn't this guy supposed to be a millionaire?
Just follow the money.
And yes, today to follow that money, we open some windows here on The Takeaway to take a look at the global economy. And we are not necessarily thrilled with the view they give us. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening anyway. A look at the oil economy in southern Louisiana turns out to be a great place to view the impact of global warming and sea level rise. We also begin a series asking why some of the numbers in the global economy aren't adding up right now. Today, how low oil prices aren't having the expected impact. Also, is a minimum wage an actual living wage? You try living on $15 an hour. But first, attorney-client privilege. Oops. The phones are lighting up in Panama today after a major leak of financial data, more than 2.6 terabytes of data, 39 years' worth of documents from inside a Panamanian law firm specializing in tax shelters and creating shell companies to hide money. The leak has revealed the offshore holdings of 140 politicians, public officials, and athletes around the world, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, although his name wasn't specifically mentioned. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov had this psychological view of the situation that fell well short of a denial. It is clear the degree of Putinophobia has reached such a level that it is impossible a priori to speak well of Russia. Well, he did not speak of any Icelandophobia or Britophobia or Sinophobia, as the documents also detail offshore tax accounts of the Prime Minister of Iceland, UK Prime Minister David Cameron's late father, and top officials in the Chinese Communist Party, including President Xi Jinping. More than 214,000 offshore entities connected to people in more than 200 countries and territories, quite a database. Over 60 media outlets are collaborating with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in publishing a series of stories based on the 11.5 million files leaked from the prominent Panama-based law firm of Mossack Fonseca, a virtual financial statement for terrorists, dictators, money launderers, and other tax evaders all over the world. Aaron Shornick is a policy advisor on banks and corruption at Global Witness, an independent nonprofit that investigates corruption in the international financial system.
This is the largest leak of financial information that we've ever seen on the scale of corruption, corporate secrecy, tax haven use, and shell companies' use is something off the roof that we haven't seen in a way to this type of scale. Prosecutions, I'm sure, are yet to come, and we're looking forward to more leaks, so the truth is yet to come in total.
And the fact that it involves mostly UK territories, does that mean this is mostly a British issue, or is the US involved as well?
Unfortunately, I wish I could say that, but a little known fact is that the US is actually one of the easiest places in the world for people to set up a company and keep that the fact that they own it or control it secret. We call these companies anonymously owned companies. The US is one of the largest incorporators in the world, and has been known for corrupt politicians to use our jurisdiction as a place to park their dirty money.
And who does this benefit primarily? Let's not speak so much of the very wealthy who are trying to avoid taxes, but the more serious issue, I suspect, is the money laundering capability that these offshore territories facilitate.
Absolutely. The sort of harms that can range from the use of these tax havens in offshore territories and corporate secrecy range from national security threats, threats to legitimate businesses, poor countries, the vulnerables here in America, and everyday taxpayers.
Would you say that ISIS is involved in using these particular tax havens?
significant amount of research had been done to connect the links between ISIS and these types of schemes, but that the point is that this corporate secrecy allows those actors to remain hidden.
So basically the idea is once the money gets this far, it's already invisible. And so if you can trace it to these UK properties, you've already lost the trail.
Absolutely. We spend a significant amount of time talking about this problem with law enforcement officials, both in New York and abroad. And the issue remains that, as you've just said, that there's a block, there's a wall. Once you hit this type of secrecy, and investigations are difficult to finish and follow through. There is a solution in the U.S., for example, where a bill is before Congress that would require all American companies, with some exceptions, to disclose the real people behind those companies and to keep that information updated. The U.K. is moving towards this type of public registry, and the EU is as well.
Is the whole banking industry represented down here, or are there some usual suspects that pop up whose names we would know?
I mean, I think the usual suspects have been in trouble time after time. There are some plans for improvement, but clearly the plans aren't in place and aren't working.
The media outlets who are collaborating with the consortium of investigative journalists who received this information received leaks from a Panama-based law firm, Mossack Fonseca. Can you tell me a little bit about this law firm?
From what I understand, the firm is hired to set up companies and do transactions for people around the world. The data is showing that some of those people included a high number of government leaders, most former. And the fact is that the companies and transactions were done to keep those people's involvement in various activities hidden. And this is a real issue, and this is not the only firm that happens to be doing this type of business.
In terms of just dollar amounts, what are we looking at?
I mean, some of the schemes that we as Global Witness have investigated throughout the years involve schemes ranging in the billions to the millions to, you know, a couple hundred thousands. So you name it, these structures using tax havens, corporate secrecy, and shell companies are being used to move all sorts of amounts of money.
And has this increased in the last few years, or is this leak just a window on something that's probably stayed pretty constant in the last decade or so?
I would venture to guess that it's something that is fairly common. Global Witness has been involved in a number of investigations, as I mentioned, one of which being interviews with New York law firms. And we sent in an undercover investigator to see exactly how easy and what the conversation looks like for someone to be working for a Western African leader and to look to buy high-end luxury goods, despite the fact that the leader's salary in his home country was the equivalent of a U.S. teacher. And what you found was a number of those lawyers recommending and suggesting that companies be used to carry out these transactions. In this investigation, no money was exchanged and no one was taken on as a client. One of those law firms actually told us that our business was not for them, and another one declined business after the interviews. This demonstrates just how easy it is for actors to move their money and to park it here in the U.S.
Aaron Shornick is a policy advisor on the banks and corruption team at Global Witness in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you. Have a good day.
The politicized U.S. judiciary is an issue at play in Washington, D.C., and it has become a real monster in at least one state race for the Supreme Court. Here are two ads in the race between Judge Joanne Kloppenburg challenging incumbent Justice Rebecca Bradley in the state of Wisconsin.
We've heard it before. Liberal judges letting criminals off on technicalities. Judges like Joanne Kloppenburg.
Our judges should be fair and impartial. But Rebecca Bradley called gays immoral, abnormal, queers, and degenerates.
This man had a long criminal history, including beating his wife in front of their 2-year-old daughter.
She even said she had no sympathy for AIDS victims.
Tell Judge Kloppenburg court should protect children, not criminals.
Ask Rebecca Bradley, with these extreme views, how can she be fair?
Now, I don't know whether you could decipher that or not, but Bradley is the conservative in this race, and Kloppenburg is the liberal. The ad against Kloppenburg was subsequently withdrawn for fact errors about child abuse. Rebecca Bradley is the incumbent and has received $1.2 million from the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform, and that's mostly out-of-state money. Bradley was appointed by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker in September of 2015. Everything about this race disturbs Justice Jeanine Geske, a former state Supreme Court justice and distinguished professor of law at Marquette University. She sees a politicized judiciary distorting American government from the federal level straight on down.
I think people that are voting in this election feel like they're either voting for the Democrat or the Republican or the conservative or the liberal. And that is highly unfortunate. Our court has already had a lot of strain on it because of some pretty significant conflict. And there are some ideological lines that are pretty clear. And then with this election, it's only exacerbating that perception by the public that the court is merely another legislative branch as opposed to that independent judiciary that I think most of us want.
What's the impact of outside money, out-of-state money?
It's huge. It's huge, particularly in Justice Bradley's case. I think that a lot of support that Governor Walker brings with him has been put into this race. And that amount of money has increased year by year. And the Republican Party is actively assisting Justice Bradley. In fact, they are listed on her campaign contributions, even though it's a nonpartisan race, that they've been putting money into the campaign. And then all the out-of-state money has been significant with very, very nasty ads, frankly, on both sides of the fence.
Well, you've heard the ads, and the tone is not something you associate with the judiciary. And I can hear in your voice, Justice, just a sense of disgust that we've gone down a road that we can't really go back from at this point. Is that your feeling?
I'm deeply saddened for a number of reasons. I truly believe that the only way our court system is effective is if people have faith that the court is, in fact, fair and impartial. If people believe that the court is in the pocket of special interests or one political party or not, people won't trust the decisions, even if the decisions themselves are based on the merits. The other part of this that's very sad is I know a lot of highly qualified judges and lawyers who will not run for the Supreme Court because of these kinds of races. They're not going to put their families and their own integrity and reputations on the line to go through such vicious campaigns. So I don't know how we go back until we get some of the money out of these campaigns, because it seems to get worse with every campaign.
And it's not simply at the state level. I mean, there's an argument that you would make at the national level as well with the U.S. Supreme Court, right?
There is. And you know, this whole fight going on whether we ought to have confirmation hearings or not, you know, and it appears, and I don't know anything about President Obama's appointee, but, you know, it appears he tried to pick somebody that was certainly middle of the road, highly respected, and yet we're having this partisan fight about whether or not the Senate should even conduct hearings. You know, we want judges that call them like they see them. And that's one of the reasons I have deep respect for Chief Justice Roberts. I mean, you know, he made a tough call for him, I'm sure, on the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, if you got a judge who's going to make the call, regardless of whether his supporters like him or not, he's probably a good judge. And I think that's who we want in those positions of incredible power, are individuals who are going to be fair and impartial and follow the law and not their ideological bents.
A heartbroken sounding Jeanine Geske, former Wisconsin Supreme Court justice. She is a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School. Last Thursday, over 50 world leaders gathered at a nuclear security summit hosted by President Obama that illustrated just how drastically the global conversation on nuclear weapons has evolved in the years since the Cold War. The Washington, D.C. summit centered around disposal of nuclear waste and weaponized nuclear fuel and keeping existing weapons away from terrorist groups like ISIS.
The danger of a terrorist group obtaining and using a nuclear weapon is one of the greatest threats to global security.
But a single use of a nuclear weapon poses virtually no threat to the global climate. But in the early 1980s, while the United States and the Soviet Union were committed to a mutually assured destruction strategy, the discussion about nuclear security was all about who would fire first and what would happen to the planet from the impact of multiple nuclear blasts. Carl Sagan and a number of other scientists said that a full-scale nuclear war would produce what they called a nuclear winter. The gases from the explosion and firestorms of nuclear blasts would block out the sun, plunge the Earth's temperature and decimate our food supply, spelling the end for humanity.
Beneath the clouds, virtually all domesticated and wild sources of food would be destroyed. Most of the human survivors would starve to death. The extinction of the human species would be a real possibility.
A new documentary from our friends at the Retro Report explores how this theory steered the Cold War strategy at the time, had real impact, and helped pull the superpowers back from the nuclear brink. With me now to talk about what lessons we may have learned from that is Andy Revkin, writer of the Dot Earth blog with the New York Times and a professor at Pace University. Welcome, Andy.
Great to be with you.
So this nuclear winter idea was very powerful at the time, and it had impact on policymakers?
Well, it was pretty stark stuff. It came at a point when people were seriously worried. You and I think, are both old enough to recall what the Cold War was like, and certainly from the 60s forward. And then, but at that time, there was a lot of tension and a lot of possible adverse outcomes. And scientists began to calculate, no one had ever actually tallied, if you burned enough cities, how much stuff would go into the air and what would that do to the climate? And they were already running, using these climate models at that time already, to do the global warming analysis, but they turned them to this task.
And the Reagan administration really ramped up the Cold War in the 1980s with the whole discussion of intermediate-range nuclear missiles. And so politically speaking, the 80s were a much more tense period than even the 1970s.
For sure. And there are signs, in retrospect, of course, the Soviet effort was straining toward the late 80s. There were a lot of things going on domestically there that were, the United States was pressuring them in many ways. And when you added this to the mix, it kind of also gave a cover in a way. Gorbachev embraced nuclear winter. Reagan talked about it a little bit, and it gave another sort of logic to it. Was like mad, mutually assured destruction plus, with an exclamation point. Not only would the war be awful, and this would guarantee no winners.
Here's Carl Sagan talking specifically about how there is really no way to assess the data.
The global consequences of nuclear war is not a subject amenable to experimental verification, or at least not more than once. Maybe we've all made some serious mistake in the calculations, but I wouldn't want to bet my life on it.
He sounds so spooky there, but he's speaking directly.
He was really good at that stuff.
Yeah, he's really good at that stuff. And he really was far more persuasive than Reagan and Gorbachev in their diplomatic speak, even as profound as those world leaders were. Sagan really got people's attention.
Yeah, I wrote a long, long magazine article about this 31 years ago now in 1985 for Science Digest. It's kind of interesting to look back at it. It's kind of a nexus when science gets policy relevant and scientists have passions about peace or about environmental security, more recently with global warming. They get empowered, and Sagan was just a particularly effective spokesman. Paul Ehrlich was involved as well, Paul Crutzen, who later went on to win a Nobel Prize, who had helped reveal the ozone destruction from CFCs, was involved. So the National Academies of Science did a follow-up study. And then what happened, the issue kind of got interesting because more analysis, this happens often in science where an initial stark idea gets picked apart and studied more thoroughly, and the models are getting more sophisticated. And it became more like nuclear autumn, which is kind of, where's the headline there? But I think, as you were implying, it kind of already did the job in a way.
And the metaphors for what mutually assured destruction actually was were very, very powerful, coming from a Carl Sagan rather than from some sort of policy analyst at the Pentagon. Here, listen.
Imagine a room awash in gasoline, and there are two implacable enemies in that room. One of them has 9,000 matches. The other has 7,000 matches. Each of them is concerned about who's ahead, who's stronger. Well, that's the kind of situation we are actually in.
Carl Sagan saying that on ABC News in 1983. Was that the kind of situation we were actually in, scientifically speaking?
Well, in the sense that, as even with nuclear autumn, you're talking about a substantial effect. And even today, scientists are pointing to that, even with a modest exchange of nuclear weapons, if there is such a thing, between, say, Pakistan and India, Alan Robach at Rutgers has calculated you could get a substantial impact globally on agriculture and that kind of thing. So it really does hold up in that sense.
But the summit last week was mostly talking about keeping existing nuclear weapons and fissile material away from terrorists. And in that case, it would pose no danger really to the planet, but it would, of course, be an extraordinary civilian tragedy.
For sure. And, you know, although, again, to me, there still is this. I write for the opinion side of the paper, so I can kind of say what I think sometimes. And, you know, anything that reminds us that there still are these big arsenals out there, and humans are still fallible, even with the fail-safe technology, supposedly, that, you know, we have to kind of keep that in mind and think about consequences that might seem ridiculous, ridiculously unlikely, but that have to be considered.
So along with the terrorist scenario, you would warn about the Dr. Strangelove scenario as well?
You know, I'd like to think it's impossible, but, you know, I've covered enough impossible or implausible things that have happened that you start to think, well, you got to take this seriously.
Talking about the nuclear winter, which became the nuclear autumn, but was a very, very powerful scientific argument during the Cold War in the 1980s. Andy Revkin is writer of the Dot Earth blog with the New York Times. He's a professor at Pace University. Thanks so much, Andy.
You're welcome.
If you want to see the retro report look back at the nuclear winter argument during the Cold War, go to thetakeaway.org. Today, California Governor Jerry Brown signs a $15 an hour minimum wage into state law, making it the highest state minimum, affecting the pay of an estimated 5.6 million workers. Last week, New York's Governor Cuomo announced that state legislators reached a budget agreement that would do just about the same, raising the minimum wage in New York City first, and then more slowly across New York suburbs. A big raise for people at the low end of the economy, but the real measure is not dollars per hour. It's whether these new minimums constitute a living wage for the people benefiting from them. Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. He joins us. He's a former chief economist to Vice President Joseph Biden. Jared, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, our measure on what a minimum wage is so subject to, you know, when we used to get the minimum wage. And so 15 might sound like a big deal to someone who's my age, but it's not to someone who's going from, you know, $11 an hour to $15 an hour. How do you begin to calculate what a minimum wage would be that would, in a particular area, and California and New York are very different, be a living wage, actually something you could live off of?
Right. I remember trying to convince FDR to go from 20 cents to 25 cents an hour back in 1930s. I'm exaggerating. I'm not that old. But that's where it started, 25 cents an hour. And of course, with inflation, the minimum wage has been raised over time. But it's always been a legislative issue. That is, it's never been linked directly to price growth, and it's certainly never been linked to regional price differences, which are very significant. What we see now are that there are 30 states in the country who are taking this minimum wage idea into their own hands and raising their levels above the federal. Lots of cities and localities are doing it as well. And part of it is very much designed to help get closer to some idea of a living wage, that is an earnings level that working families can make ends meet with. However, especially in expensive parts of the country, it certainly doesn't meet that benchmark yet.
What communities are close? And let's assume that New York City is probably not one of them because the cost of living is so high here, and San Francisco probably the same.
Well, I think the closest communities are places where costs aren't as high as they are in the coastal cities you mentioned, but the minimum wage is elevated. So some of our Midwestern cities have higher minimum wages. Washington, D.C. has a relatively high minimum wage. Of course, we have relatively high living standards here as well. But I think it's really important to remember that it's not just the minimum wage that helps families get to, if not a living wage, a living income. There's a very important public policy called the Earned Income Tax Credit. There's also a smaller tax credit called the child tax credit. And these are refundable tax credits, meaning that you get them even if you don't have a tax bill, that help get family incomes closer to an amount that they need to get by. And for a family working full-time with a couple of kids, the EITC can add $5,000 to your annual income. So that, in tandem with a higher minimum wage, that's certainly getting some families closer to a living income.
We see populist politicians, you know, signing a minimum wage law for political reasons, and I think that that's good and fine. But are there any places that are strategically combining a look at the minimum wage with the earned income tax credit and creating a tandem of policies that are going to overall benefit families in any strategic way?
Not enough, although the EITC is a national program. But one of the problems with some of these benefit programs is that as your earnings go up, sometimes your benefits go down. So you do have to try to balance that out. And I think public policy isn't quite there yet. And I appreciate the fact that you're framing this in terms of helping people to earn what they need to get by, because nowadays more and more people are really dependent on these low wages. We're not just talking about, you know, teenagers. We're talking about families with kids.
Jared Bernstein is senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington and a former chief economist to Vice President Joseph Biden. Jared, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Port Fourchon is one of the busiest oil ports in the world. The offloaded carbon here on the southernmost tip of Louisiana gets consumed, and its impact is felt in the slow rise of the Gulf waters that lap at the shore and encroach on the roadways. It's a game of carbon poker here at Port Fourchon. The waters rise, and the roads need to be raised to stay above those waters.
For travel by land, unimpeded access to Port Fourchon, regardless of weather conditions, has been vastly improved by the elevated Louisiana Highway 1 from Leeville. Elevated LA1 has increased accessibility to the interstate system, greatly expanding the economies of the shipping, tourism and recreation, and commercial fishing industries. Elevated LA1 also provides a secure evacuation route for tens of thousands of people in the event of a storm.
Ted Fogle rolls his eyes a bit listening to that industrial video about this port he loves. He's seen it all in his 30 years in the oil game, and he's not sure who is winning. Would you say you're a climate change activist at this point?
Well, I'm a climate change participant. I have to deal with it every day, and I think coastal Louisiana is going to be the fishbowl that everybody gets to watch and learn and hopefully decide how we're going to deal with this situation, because it's going to start impacting more and more coastal communities across the country and world.
Ted Fogle could take you on a helicopter tour of Port Fourchon, and you could spend hours watching giant offshore rigs, massive tankers, huge service vessels, acres of cranes and pipelines, pumping stations, and lines of trucks waiting to pick up and drop off. Port Fourchon is big, all right, Ted would say, but the forces at work in sea level rise might be bigger.
My experience in the oil and gas industry dates back probably 35 plus years now, and certainly we started, you know, back 30 years ago, it was mostly inshore or nearshore activity, and then you saw a gradual movement to the deeper and deeper waters of the Gulf of Mexico as technology improved and incentives allowed the industry to go out deeper. Today, it probably matches what NASA has done to go the other direction. We have probably equal technology and capabilities to go into the ground in 7,000 to 10,000 feet of water now in dealing with all those stresses and produce.
Isn't it strange that all of a sudden that water level in the Gulf is a force that you have to reckon with? Tell me how you began to discover that that was enough of a phenomenon that it was going to impede your ability to do your work.
Well, we clearly understand sea level rise and have been experiencing it for
quite some time and fully believe that it's increasing. Its rate is increasing. We have elevated highways, raised property within the port. Because the port sits on the Gulf of Mexico and the nature of a seaport where there's lots of dredging that occurs, we have the capability to build land higher. We have for long been doing that to sustain ourselves out into the future. Untypical, perhaps, of a port. We have been one of the leaders in coastal restoration way before it ever became cool to do, you know, coastal restoration.
How would you respond to people who want to maintain that, in fact, there's no human-caused climate change when you're seeing the tangible results of it?
I think there are many, many parameters at work here. The greenhouse effect has the ability to change temperatures, but changes in many things, both related and unrelated to the carbon issue.
Where are you going to get the money to continue these mitigation efforts as the sea level rises slowly? Where are you going to get the money? Where are those resources going to come from?
And that's a very good question, okay? Louisiana has lost the size of Rhode Island in land over the last 30 years. So we've been dealing with this for quite some time. We have spent billions of dollars already in dealing with it, but as we get closer and closer to the water level, we have to get more and more aggressive. The federal government collects billions from offshore oil and gas lease revenues and has not shared with the state anything prior to just recent. And then now we're going to start sharing in offshore revenues a bit. And that's when we have dedicated it constitutionally to be spent on coastal restoration.
But you're in quite a position there to basically cover the costs of the kind of investments you have to make to deal with sea level rise. That becomes an argument for more drilling for oil to get that money to do what you need to do, which probably makes things worse over the long haul.
Let me make a prediction for you that if we didn't have oil and gas production and we weren't so significant to this nation's energy, we would not be getting revenue sharing. There would be environmental concerns that care about the catastrophic loss of coastal Louisiana, but there would be no one coming in with the big bucks to try to help save it.
Does it ever feel like Mother Nature is playing a joke on you, or you're unsuccessfully playing a joke on her?
It depends how you define success. I'm a Cajun, which is French. We run out of Nova Scotia and settled in South Louisiana and had nothing there and took the challenges. We'll continue to work and find ways to enjoy the estuaries in our way of life. And production of energy allows us to do that. And I know you can make the case that, oh, well, you're just exacerbating the situation. But as I said, if we didn't produce 30% of the nation's energy supply, very few people would care about coastal Louisiana washing into the sea. And obviously people care now. We're having this conversation.
Ted Falgul is the former director of Port Fouchon and chairman of the Louisiana One Coalition. He joined us from Louisiana. We spoke to Ted as part of our collaboration with WBEZ Chicago's Heat of the Moment project. It's also in collaboration with IC Change. Find out more at icchange.org. And for more from the series, please visit heatofthemoment.org. That's right. Here's something to take with you today. Spain's prime minister wants to deep six the siesta in an attempt to bring Spanish business hours more in line with European neighbors. The workday starts at 10 a.m. At 2 p.m., they take a three-hour break, then leave for the day at 8 p.m. That is 7 hours a day, technically, but the government says cutting the siesta would raise the quality of life, raise the low birth rates, and reduce marriage breakdowns. Marriage breakdowns? What's going on during these siestas? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.